and we will move on to the next case of this morning, Trask Morton versus Motel 6. Yes, Mr. Wolgemuth.
May it please the court, my name is Joel Wolgemuth, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Marilyn Trask Morton, along with Jolynn Jeter, who is with me at the council table today. May it please the court, in getting to the key issue in this case with respect to the foreseeability of the harm that was suffered by the plaintiff at the Motel 6 property, there are several factors that the cases rely upon, and in fact the district court mentioned in part in its decision in looking at the totality of the circumstances.
But could we back up for a minute, because I thought one of the key issues, or maybe the key issue, is in fact causation. The record is requires an awful lot, I'll say, in the way of inference to get from any injury that Ms. Trask Morton may have suffered to Motel 6 responsibility for that. There's just an enormous amount of guessing that has to go on. And the district court found that essentially there was too much, that she had not come forth with enough evidence to go forward on a claim against Motel 6.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think, in fact, the district court ultimately made the conclusion in his opinion that the plaintiff's erratic behavior in the lobby could have just as likely been the cause of harm as her claim as to what occurred in the lawsuit. And, of course, we believe that is weighing the evidence and not looking at the summary judgment standard. But nevertheless,
He says that, but I saw that as a kind of a for instance, because there are so many for instances she could have. Since she has no memory from the time she went to sleep until the next day when she wakes up in the hospital, she could have been sleepwalking through the hotel and fallen down. Somebody could have come in. She could have encountered them. She could have hurt herself in the lobby. I mean, you can go on and on and on. You have nothing that would tend to point to some responsibility on Motel 6's part for this.
When we look at, Your Honor, when we look at that issue, we need to look, I believe, at some specific issues of security that inform the duty of care.
Why is it a security issue if she, in a stupor because of whatever, maybe a medical problem, maybe the medication she was taking, opens the door and walks out into the hallway and slips and falls? I mean, that might not be security. You know, I'm just guessing. I don't really know what happened, but I'm not sure we can even get to the point of being confident it's a security lapse.
Well, we do know that she was found injured on the property.
We do know that.
That was undisputed.
Right. And the EMT calls the ambulance. We know that.
Yes. And we know that subsequent examinations reflected substantial bruising, redness at her cervix, a knot on her head, definitely things that we don't know what happened. There is no eyewitness to what occurred, but could be consistent with having been assaulted.
We don't know what happened, but I guess here, too, I found the record very incomplete, I'll say, because when you place a lot of weight on the fact that the cervix is red, for example, but there's no expert testimony from a gynecologist or somebody to express an opinion about why that might be. It could be from disease, it could be from assault, it could be from medication, it could be from anything. I mean, I'm not a doctor, I don't know, but I would have expected to see some expert opining about that.
And she was of course treated at the Wishart Center of Hope afterwards for potential sexual assault, and she was also treated thereafter in Oklahoma by her doctor with symptoms such as post-traumatic stress.
Well, which could come from a regular assault as well. Where's the evidence?
Well, and of course, she believes she was sexually assaulted. The issue is, was she harmed?
But she doesn't know, right? She doesn't know what happened to her.
She doesn't know, and of course, she could have been in a coma. We have wrongful death cases. I don't think there's a specific requirement that the plaintiff have recollection necessary to make the causal link.
Not at all, but you would expect to see some evidence that would point you in the direction of that versus something else. And I'm saying the only evidence you have I find so inconclusive. It's, you know, without supplementing it from some expert saying these are the physical consequences I would expect to see if a certain type of assault occurred.
And I think one of the issues in trying to deal with the totality of circumstances leading to injury, courts have looked at the security issues to see whether or not there are extensive breaches of security that may have led to the injury suffered. In this case, just by way of example, the key card system, we have evidence of a key card usage in this room on two occasions on December 6th, prior to the time that the plaintiff checked in. There's evidence that the keys were checked out by two housekeepers contrary to company policy, were not recorded as required, and there was another entry into the room at 4:20 p.m. that afternoon, which cannot be explained at all by the defendant with respect to the second entry into the room. So there were two entries, one at 2:25 and one at 4:20, with the motel's key card system off by 54 minutes.
Did you depose all of the housekeepers?
Yes, we did.
And what did they say?
The housekeepers had no idea why the second entry to room 330 occurred at 4:20 p.m. Miss Whipps also entered the room again on the 7th, and she had no idea why she did that. And she came back on the 8th. Miss Whipps is one of the housekeepers, and checked out keys between 10:40 and 3:35, with no explanation as to she was not on duty or as to why she came back that day and checked keys out that could be used to gain entrance to room 330. So there were...
Now, is she one of the people with a criminal record?
No, she's not. She was not one of the people with a criminal record. And the actual person who cleaned the room, that was her friend Jennifer Welch, who cleaned the room at 2:25 and then went out with Miss Whipps, taking the keys off premises. I might also mention, Your Honor, that the district court did rely upon the fact on two occasions that there was a security guard on duty, which is a major issue in these cases from the standpoint of deterrence. And that particular finding, conclusion, was based on an affidavit that was totally in conflict with the Motel 6 incident reports. Its investigative report, which incidentally, this is the Monarch report that was not part of the summary judgment record. The court relied on the Monarch report because it was filed in connection with the spoliation issues and did not note that that report indicates there was no security guard on duty
right.
that night as well.
I mean, all of that may be true. I mean, of course, we take the facts in the light most favorable to Ms. Trask Morton, but I guess I still keep coming back to a lack of reasons to hang my hat on the thought that whatever it is that happened to her was the responsibility of the motel, whether your theory is that it was an employee of the motel, whether your theory is that a failure to monitor the third floor frequently enough allowed some third party to get in. You know, I just see a lot of vagueness out there.
This circuit has said, in looking at focusing on this issue in the Omni case, the greater the likelihood of harm with respect to the particular property, the more extensive are the measures which need to be employed by the property to protect the guests. And I think
do you have to post a guard outside every door? I mean, suppose the security guard was on duty, but it was during one of the 50-minute periods of time that he wasn't walking past that door. Well, then one security guard's not enough. Now, if the security guard was off duty, as is conceivable given the time sequence that you spell out, maybe that's a different story. I mean, it's hard to know.
Well, and there's no, in this case, the overwhelming evidence, except for the self-serving affidavit of Travis Sperry, is there was no security guard. Document after document of Motel 6 established that. There's no report of any security guard activity. In fact, there are no security guard reports at all ever produced by Motel 6 with respect to the security that was employed at this property.
But a jury wouldn't even get to the question of the adequacy of the hotel's security measures unless it could answer the question about causation of her injuries in her favor, which is to say, unless there's evidence from which the jury could conclude by the greater weight of the credible evidence that she was raped. And that's what's missing here.
Yes,
it's all speculation.
Well,
the fact that she thinks she was raped is not good enough.
The plaintiff admittedly has no memory. And I think what the courts do is to take a look at the totality of the circumstances on a summary judgment basis, whether there's a disputed fact as to whether or not the injury was caused from the caused in accordance with the plaintiff's claim.
But you need more than speculation, and that's all that's here.
And I agree with this, certainly, Your Honor, I agree with that. But one of the things the cases point to in determining whether or not there is an issue of fact is the criminal history of the property, and that is whether or not there are facts, as in this case, 121 incident reports in 3.5 years with respect to crime occurring at this property, including rape, assault, burglary, drugs.
That's not circumstantial evidence that her injuries were caused by a sexual assault. That goes to the exercise of due care by the hotel, which, as I said, is the secondary issue. You've got to prove to your civil burden that she was raped.
Well, that she was harmed. We believe, again, that she was raped, but the question is whether she was assaulted, sexually assaulted, or assaulted and was harmed. And admittedly, under circumstances where she has no memory of the actual event, which takes you back, Your Honor, to the totality of circumstances test to determine whether or not there are facts looking at each of these discrete security issues. No exterior cameras, no security guard, no reliable key lock system, missing keys that would be facts that a jury may consider.
I was going to ask about Spielman, because there seems to be some inconsistency what he said happened, and as far as converging in her story,
yes,
about driving the truck and his presence and whether he was in and out of the apartment when it helped clean it up. Somebody got into the makeup. I don't know, is there some reason that he would get into the makeup? There are different questions that he presents as well that seem to confuse the problem.
That's correct, Aaron. Those were issues that occurred after the event, and he was given access by Motel 6 to her room on December the 7th, which led to those particular issues.
But he was the first one in.
Yes, he was.
Right.
Yes, absolutely. That would be a jury issue.
All right, if you'd like to save the rest of your time for rebuttal, that would be fine. Mr. Abrahamson.
Morning, report, please, counsel. There are a couple of statements, comments made by counsel that I think are not complete or not consistent with the record. When Ms. Morton went in to the hospital about 11:30 the morning of the 7th, she was in the emergency room. She was incoherent. She was treated. And about 5 o'clock that afternoon, she was released. And there is absolutely nothing in the records of her first admission indicating that she complained to anybody about any type of an assault having taken place. There is nothing in those hospital records that indicate any bruises, any contusions, any redness, etc. Now, she said, and her deposition indicates, that they wanted to do a spinal tap. And she was sufficiently coherent at that time that when she said she refused it. That's an invasive procedure. I don't want it. She said she wanted to leave the hospital, which she did. Then said she called a taxi and had a taxi take her back to the motel. And when she got to the motel, she told the taxi driver, since I came from the hospital, I don't have my purse. If you'll come up to my room, I will get my purse and I will pay you. She said when she got to her room, she told the taxi driver who was in the room with her, someone stole my purse. And he said, I've heard that story before. Now, she then talked about making these phone calls, etc., to her son and closing a bank account because she said she had $170,000 in her checking account. And the following morning, the motel calls the police.
Can I back up? I mean, the first visit to the hospital.
Yes.
I'm just looking at her brief. The records indicate only that she was disoriented, she had slurred speech, she's confused, and she's got a hypothermic body temperature for some reason. And it's not until she goes back that the hospital, the same hospital, finds... She, you know, she feels a large knot in her head. She
like the following day, 24 hours later.
And bruises and extreme pain and so on and so forth. So, and she, at that point, asks to go back to the hospital.
24 hours later, she goes back to the hospital.
At what point did she wake up in the hospital?
I don't think the records show what time she woke up, but the records show she was discharged sometime between 5 and 6 p.m. on Sunday the 7th, about 6 hours after she gets there.
It was the first time in the hospital when she was when she refused the spinal tap.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
When the first trip to the hospital, she refused the spinal tap. Is that
correct? That's
correct. Because at that point, she obviously had woken up.
Exactly.
And I'm just trying to determine at what point. What time of day that was or whatever. I happened to have a spinal tap a long time ago. It was a wise decision not to get
it. Well, I'm assuming it must have been shortly before she discharged. I don't think the record shows that, but she was discharged sometime between 5 and 6 o'clock.
Okay, but I'm just trying to determine if she's in some kind of a stupor. We don't know. If she's hypothermia, she may have been laying outside for a while.
We don't know.
And that's. I'm just trying to get a time.
We don't know.
Okay.
Now, Mr. Spielman, who comes to the hotel about the time she's going into the ambulance, says that he gets directions to the ambulance, to the hospital, and he then gets the truck that she had rented in Oklahoma, whether it's empty or full of cigarettes, I don't know, and I don't know that it matters here, but he gets the truck, and he finds the truck, what he says, parked improperly, not in a, quote, regular parking space. And the keys are in the grass, not in the parking lot, not in the room, not in the truck. There's absolutely no explanation as to how this happened, how we wind up with truck keys in the grass. Pamela Stewart, the desk clerk who checked her in that night, has a declaration that said when she came up, she was in the company of a man. But he did not come into the office. She came in by herself. Now,
I'm not sure what we're to make of this truck evidence. I'm not sure of what relevance whether the U-Haul was parked well or not has to this case.
Well, I don't know that it does or not, but what I'm saying is we don't know whether that's where she parked it, whether she got up and when she went someplace after she checked into her room. We have no idea.
The key card would have been, I assume, from what I understand from this record about the key card system, is that the records would have shown another entry into the room, you know, 4 a.m. if she'd gone out or some time. Yeah, go ahead.
Now, the key card would show not if she went out, but if she locked the door and came back.
Right.
Then the key card would show another entry. Mr. Spielman said that when he got there and went up to the room was open. The door was unlocked, and her cell phone was on the concrete outside, even though Mr. Zickerman and Tammy Belcher, the desk clerk, said that when she was in the lobby, the cell phone kept ringing and ringing and ringing. But Mr. Spielman said that he found her cell phone. Now,
does she have two cell phones?
I don't know. I don't think so. There's no evidence that she had two cell phones. And what happened was that her deposition was taken before Mr. Spielman, and we did not know that Mr. Spielman was going to say that he found this cell phone outside. Now, the Marion County Sheriff's Department records indicate that when she came back from the hospital, the following morning, she told the sheriff's deputies that when she came back from the hospital Sunday night, she hooked up again with Mr. Spielman in her room Sunday night. When we asked Mr. Spielman about what happened after he saw her in the hospital, he alternately refused to answer or said, "I have no recollection."
Well, Mr. Spielman is essentially, if we can call him this, her business partner, right? He's the person that she's arranging whatever this is that she's doing.
She said business partner. He said he was pinch hitting for his brother, and he was on a, helping his brother out. He had no business arrangement with her, no financial arrangement.
This is not a personal friendship or anything. This is somehow or another a business
deal. Well, he said there was a personal. Apparently, she used to work for their father, who was in the wholesale tobacco business. And he said he got the call from his brother, said, "I got a truckload of cigarettes that's going to an Indian tribe in upstate New York. Marilyn Morton knows these people. She would be the contact. I can't go. Would you pinch hit for me?" That's different from what she says, and I don't know that it matters, but it just...
No, I mean, we have to get back to whether there's anything that Motel 6 did or didn't do that put her in a position where she was going to be assaulted. I would like to put to one side whether it was a sexual assault or any other kind of assault, because it seems to me by the time we have the second set of records from Wishart Hospital, there's evidence in the record of an assault of some type. And, of course, assaults of any type, if the motel is responsible for them, would be the kind of thing she might be able to recover on, if the motel had something to do with it.
We don't believe there's any evidence whatsoever. And the record and the Marion County Sheriff's report, plus the declaration of Jeffrey Stagg, who made the report, who was not deposed, said that when he interviewed her, she told him she didn't think she was assaulted. Now, that was Monday morning. She comes back to the motel from the hospital the second night.
But Monday morning is that when she's incoherent?
No, that was Sunday morning.
Oh, Sunday morning, okay.
Right, this is 24 hours later.
All right.
This is 24 hours later. The police are there, and she's saying, "No, I don't think I was assaulted." And so he puts that in his report. He puts in his declaration.
But she's already seen at this point the disheveled room when she makes the statement about she didn't think she was assaulted.
She said she has seen the disheveled room. That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. With regard to the security guard and counsel's statement that there's nothing there except his self-serving declaration, that's not consistent with the record. The record that shows the time that he was paid, it shows his employee number, and it shows he was, in fact, signed in and signed out from 11 o'clock the night of the 6th until 4-something the morning of the 7th. So those are records of the motel.
But nobody replaces him at that point.
No one's on duty after
4 a.m.
Nobody replaces him at that point. That's correct. And as far as counsel's statement that the incident report shows that there was no security guard on duty, that's correct. But the incident report also indicates that they're reporting something that was reported at 10 o'clock in the morning, on Sunday morning, where somebody comes in the office and Tammy Belcher, the desk clerk, says, "There was something wrong with this woman. I asked her, could I call the ambulance? She said no. I called my manager. The manager said yes." And so she makes out that incident report, and it shows 10 o'clock in the morning. And the question is, was there a security guard on duty? And she puts no. And, of course, there was no security guard on duty at 10 o'clock in the morning. We believe that the district court was correct. Your Honor commented, it looks like speculation upon speculation upon speculation. Let's go after the motel. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the motel either did something or didn't do anything that either caused or contributed to cause this assault she's talking about. With regard to the comment in Judge McKinney's order about a possible discrepancy concerning the location of the shower curtain, I'm not sure there is a discrepancy. The plaintiff testified in her deposition that when she came into the room, that the configuration was such that there was a sink in the room, and then there's a separate room with a toilet and a shower and a bathtub, or I don't know, a bathtub and a shower, that she did not have to go to the toilet, and so she did not go in that room.
I mean, that's obviously her theory, that somebody was hiding behind the shower curtain and they came out and assaulted her after she took this muscle relaxant.
I'm sorry?
I think that's her theory of the case, as I understand
it.
That someone was hiding behind the shower curtain.
I guess that's what she's saying. And she's saying someone was hiding behind the shower curtain. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever. And the question is, she said the shower curtain was halfway over. Now, in her brief, her counsel said the shower curtain was halfway over, parenthesis, from the wall. She didn't say that. She said halfway over. Now, does that mean halfway from the wall or in the middle? We don't know. There is no evidence. Now, and we pointed that out in our reply brief in the district court, that this from the wall is not in her testimony. That was in parenthesis in counsel's brief. Now, as far as Jennifer Welsh is concerned, what Jennifer Welsh said, and that would be understandable, she's deposed, three years after the alleged incident, or 2.5 years, and basically what she said was that the practice was that when you cleaned a room, you took the shower curtain and you put it in the middle of the tub and you put a towel over it. That was the practice. So whether that, number one, creates any type of discrepancy, and if so, can the plaintiff predicate a case on saying, well, you know, the shower, there might have been somebody hiding behind the shower curtain, and I was in the room and I didn't know anything about it. It's pure speculation. We believe that the judgment should be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wolgamuth.
One point on the security guard issue. The Monarch report, which is the investigative report, which the district judge cited in the summary judge order, specifically stated that, quote, a security guard was not working during the time of the incident. So their own investigator made that determination, and the general manager indicated Ms. Stewart that security guards, or she did nothing at all to ensure proper activity and patrolling by security guards.
What was the time of the incident?
The time of the incident was sometime between 12:32 a.m. and when Ms. Morton appeared at the lobby the next morning, which was disputed, 8 to 9 a.m.
Well, that's a pretty long time of the incident.
Yes, it would be
Have been after 4 o'clock when the security guard was gone.
That's certainly a possibility. That's a possibility. The other point I wanted to mention on causation, Your Honor, is the Monteleone case out of the Fifth Circuit was a case of no memory, and the defendant claiming that there was the plaintiff's story was a sham and the plaintiff was intoxicated and later wound up in an alley outside of the Monteleone Hotel. Court there indicated that was a jury question with respect to the causation of his injuries. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel, and we'll take the case under advisement.